There's an audience, and we said, raise your hand if you haven't made a mistake. Nobody's going to do that. But yet we'll jump on these mistakes that young people make.
For me, restorative justice is a substantial paradigm shift because it focuses right from the beginning on a different aspect of what's happening here. In other words, it sees crime differently, so its definition of the problem is different, and its response is totally different. It sees crime as harm done to people, and its response is then to say who was harmed and what do we need to do about it, as opposed to saying a law was broken, you know, let's establish who broke the law and let's punish them. That's very offender focused. What we're talking about here is something that is more inclusive, to talk about the harm that's done to all the parties.
This is not about simply a shift in dealing with criminal work, you know. Well, this case goes there, this case goes there. This is about a fundamental change in society. This is about, I might say a revolution, but an evolution. But it's an evolution back to a time in which I think the seeds of democracy came from, where everybody was important, and everybody was respected, and everybody had a responsibility to make the community a healthy place to be.
For me, one of the big things about restorative justice is asking different questions. The question of what does it mean to heal from a serious violent offense? What does it mean for a community to heal from the trauma of war and refugee status? Yeah, we have huge disruptions in immigrant communities that are coming from war-torn countries and who have experienced things that are unthinkable to us. And some of that unresolved trauma ends up in our criminal justice system. What does it mean to think about healing from severe child abuse when someone is in their teens? I think that we are just at the very, very beginnings of even thinking about what the questions are that would help us be healthier as communities, much less answering them.
I think that everyone who works in the field of corrections should have some idea of victimology, the study of victims. That when people work in corrections, they get criminology. But at the heart of everyone, I believe, is a trauma. And if the education was focused on trauma, they would have a way different perspective in dealing with the victim and the offender. And I mean, the folks that we see, both offenders and victims, aren't just one trauma. Most people are layers and layers and layers of trauma from the time they were little, and it never stopped.
There's a huge gap between what would be a healthy response to trauma and what our typical societal response to it has been. And so when we hear the term restorative justice, we're starting to hear people are recognizing this. They're trying to do something about it. They're trying to say there's a better way. The old way clearly is not working. And what might that better way be? It might be that we have to be more in line with the way people really are and what's really going on for them, and not so much what our institutions have said needs to go on for them. One of the things that we know now is that there are some brain chemicals and some hormones that are shooting through our body and through our brain and through our vital organs during trauma. And that these chemicals have a main purpose. Their main purpose is to help us to survive this trauma. Survival is the number one purpose. If you can't absolutely escape it and survive it, maybe you could at least get out of it with just a little bit of damage. So it's a damage control or an escape system that gets put into place. We understand that with every kind of trauma, there's going to be self-blame. The only reasonable social response following trauma is compassion.
It isn't about reintegrative shaming, where people try to humiliate the perpetrator so perp feels horrible. It's that the opposite happens. People express themselves, and the healing takes place because we can feel part of the community as we all express our feelings. Perp, who's out there now on the periphery without having known he or she, he for the moment, that he was in the periphery, says, I'm not in. I'm out. And wants in. All of our family group conferences, all of our restorative process is really based on our ability to let victims and offenders together, hopefully, and their families, those who care about both, express who they are.
There's no one out there that doesn't want to be cared for or loved. And don't we understand that? You know, that that's the way, you know, that we need to treat. Again, it's our kids, right? Our kids. Our kids, you know. And they're the future of this world, right? And so how is it that we've become so disconnected from them? How is it that we become so disconnected with our own selves and each other that we're struggling now to find out, you know, what will work for them?
You know, when you ask the questions of, is this going to change things, or is this, you know, restorative stuff, whatever it might be, I say, is there room for kindness in there? Is there room to show somebody that we really care? That's going to make the difference. That's the ingredient we've been missing. So that's a challenge to everybody.
Good evening. This video that we have just watched is called In Search of Healing, Searching for the Principle of Restorative Justice. This is part of a collection of passionate stories that takes us to our journeys to change paradigms, and some call this restorative justice. This film has a challenging posture in terms of different positions, in terms of trauma, recovery, and the principles, psychological principles of the restorative approaches. In Search of Healing is the first of many documentaries focusing on really go through and understand the restorative justice produced by the Canadian organization, Hertz Production. It's available on their website, www.hertzspeakproduction.ca. Well, this is the 88th Forum of the Committee for the Culture of Peace. This is the last one this year and the second to last in this decade that will finish in November, this coming November, that's November 9, with a forum that will take place and being lectured by Dr. Merlova from UNESCO in Brazil, and with the proposition of celebrating all the achievements of 10 years of actions and of promoting and fostering all the actions of peace and nonviolence established by the United Nations and headed by UNESCO. In these 11 years of uninterrupted actions, we have to say we're very proud of that. That started in 1999 with a group of people, movements, and institutions that really took on themselves the responsibility to promote, encourage society to take on their role with the six principles of the 2000 Manifesto of a culture of peace and nonviolence, to respect life, reject violence, to be generous, to listen, to understand, to protect our planet, and to rediscover solidarity. It seems simple to say. In any case, these six commitments were elaborated by a 1998 Nobel Prize winner during the celebrations of the 50th anniversary of the Human Rights Declaration, and brought in the 2000 Manifesto of Nonviolence and Peace that introduced the decade to from 2001 to 2010. The commission is responsible for fostering this manifesto in Brazil. Just in the state of São Paulo, we were able to raise 500,000 commitments on paper, and we can't even measure how this was able to spread through electronic means. We know that in Brazil it was almost 14 million signatures to the 2000 Manifesto, and around the world around 70 million. Since then, the committee has taken on some reflection and actions with the coordination of Palas Atenas through a commitment agreement in partnership with UNESCO. In the 11 years of activities, the committee inspired and predicated many of its initiatives all around the country through forums as this one, through courses, workshops, seminars, institutional programs, all the way to peace committees linked to our legislative and executive bodies. Recognized internationally, the works of this committee is a very integrated, complex work based on the eight axles for the peace action. And first is peace culture through education, sustainable movement, commitment with all human rights, equality among or between the genders, democratic participation, understanding, tolerance, solidarity, communication, participative communication, free flow of information and knowledge, and peace and security. International peace and security. We would like to thank all volunteers that directly or indirectly contribute to hold these forums, and to MASPI, thank Deborah, Christine for letting us be here for this session. Today's forum, which celebrates also the 29th Gandhi week and also the nonviolence that was celebrated in October, two, this brings us back to a real possibility of a present and future that will be transforming for a pacifying arrangement of conflicts and to reach consensus. The regular processes have been applied to the judicial systems, to schools, to communities, and to workplaces. The circular processes have been taken in many areas and being determined what needs should be reached, and are able to really create the breach of vicious cycles where we have victims later as offenders. We would like to thank the support of Mali and the American consulate that was able to bring Kay Prentice to Brazil. We would also like to thank the presence of our council, Thomas J. Dolly, the director of press and culture of the American consulate, representing the American consulate here in São Paulo. We would like to also thank Professor Kay Prentice, an independent instructor, facilitator of many courses of circular process, and to really share with us your knowledge, and we'd like to say that after this forum, we're going to have a signature session for her book, The Basic Manual of Circle or Processes, and we will all be here. You're all invited. Professor, please, if you come to the stage. Thank you.
So we'll see first if all the technology is working. Yeah, that sounds like it's okay. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. And the tears are very close for me because of the film. Harold Gattensby and Phil Gattensby and Barry Stewart were my teachers in the circle process. And to hear their voices and hear their words once again touched me deeply and just reminds me of how much this work is a part of my spirit and my emotions, as well as of my head. And so I'm so honored to have been invited here, and I want to say thank you to Pallas Athena and to UNESCO and to the American Consulate. I never dreamed of traveling to Brazil to talk about this work, and so it's a wonderful, it's beyond dreams for me to be here. And in these 2 days, I arrived Sunday morning after a 10-hour flight, during most of which I slept, and I needed to move because I had been stuck in a seat for the 10 hours. So I went for a walk, and I had asked Leah if it was safe to walk in the area, and on the map, there was a nice large space that was identified as a park, and I figured out a route to walk to the park. And I walked there, and I stumbled onto a statue of Gandhi. I had no idea that Gandhi had any connection to my being here. But I stumbled onto this statue, and I stopped. And I stood for a bit and asked for his guidance, that I might be here in a good way, that I might be here in service to that wonderful vision that he shared in his life. So yesterday, as I sat with the staff of Pallas Athena, I mentioned, well, first, in listening to them, I understood that Gandhi's vision was very central to the work of Pallas Athena. And then they told me more. After I mentioned visiting the statue, that in fact that statue is there because of Pallas Athena. So I feel that the synchronicity of events is a part of the joy and the wonder of the work that I'm part of and that brought me here. And I'm just deeply, deeply grateful to be able to sit with the staff of Pallas Athena and the people that I met yesterday morning, and the people that I met this morning. I'm very, very touched by the depth of the commitment among those who are working in this area. And I believe that for those that I've met and talked to, that your understanding of restorative justice is at a deep value level, not just a technique level, and that's what really matters to me. So I feel that I'm learning from you, and that it's a great joy for me to be here and to spend time with you. I have some prepared words that I may get to, but I'm touched by the ideas of Gandhi and some of the pieces of the film that are about trauma. I want to share with you that in the United States, we're also looking at how restorative justice and peacemaking circles can be used to address historical harms, the traumas of whole groups of people at the hands of the government in the United States historically. So the institution where Howard Zaire works, at Eastern Mennonite University, they have a project bringing together descendants of slaves and descendants of slave owners to sit in circle and to talk to each other, to talk about the history, to talk about where they are today, and to work toward healing. So this restorative framework is one that's very, very useful for us to think about how we heal harms of the past, that though they were in the past, their effects are still with us today. And it is in the state that I come from, in Minnesota, the most important historical harms for us to begin to face and address are the harms that we did to Native nations when the Europeans moved through America and took land and took culture away from people and destroyed the very essence of their self-identity. So the work varies from ordinary fights in schools and street crime all the way to these very large questions about how do we heal? How do we heal from the past? How do we heal from what's happening in the present? And I'm very hopeful that we can get better and better at this. I think we're, as I mentioned in the film, we're very much at the beginning of even understanding what are the right questions to ask. But we will explore many, many different questions. We'll figure out which ones are really productive for us. And we'll get better at this. Because as humans, we have an impulse to heal. We have an impulse to be connected to one another in a good way. It's in our biology. It's in our genes that we wish to be connected to one another in a good way. Human beings evolved in community. Human beings did not evolve as individual actors. We evolved in community. Our biology knows what it is we need to do to be in community in a good way. We have disconnected from that in many ways in modern culture, but we can find our way back if we give ourselves permission to reconnect to what's in our genetic makeup about how to be in good relationships with one another, how to be in community with one another. I wish to apologize that I don't speak Portuguese. I really appreciate your patience with the translation process and the very good work done by the translators. And I appreciate your work at making it possible for me to be here, even though I can only speak my own language. I'm going to share with you some of the basic ideas of the peacemaking circle process, which is one of the restorative justice practices. And my experience is largely in the U.S. and Canada. So any experience is culturally bound. Some of it may fit for you and some may not. I invite you to take what fits and just release that which doesn't and adapt anything that you hear that feels useful to your own circumstances. Nobody else ever has answers for a community. It is the community itself that needs to figure out what's best for that particular community. I want to begin by sharing the voice of a young person. In western Minnesota, there's a county, it's a very rural county with several communities. Each community has a circle, and they take juvenile cases from the juvenile justice system, and they work with the young people and their families for a few weeks, a few months, or maybe a year, just depending upon how long it takes for that person to get stabilized. And they work through all kinds of things with these young people and the families. And it's largely community volunteers who and other family support members. They had this young man in Circle. They had worked with him for quite a long time. They meet every other week. He was doing well. They had a celebration circle to celebrate his success. And he was released from the circle process. But then they heard that he got into some trouble again. So they brought him back to the circle. And they gave him an assignment. They told him to write a paper about where he was when he came into circle. How did he think? How did he feel? Then to write about where he is today. How does he think now at that time? And how did he feel? How did he relate to people? And where did he see himself in the future? How did he see himself in community and family? So this is what the young man wrote. And he took a position of how he saw himself in the future. So he wrote, "A boy and his father are fishing. The boy says to his father, 'Dad, what were you like when you were young?' The father takes a deep breath and says, 'Well, my son, I wasn't the person you see today. See, I was a young, troubled teen. I had neither care nor any remorse for my actions. I did what I wanted to do. At that point in my life, I lost someone very important to me. I did not know what to do. I would not care for life or anything. I would hope for death to come and get me at any time, and that I would be fine with it. I would get into fights and not care for who I would hurt along my path. I had the shortest fuse, and I would snap at any time. My father would always be drunk and yell at me and your aunt along with your grandma. Every night I would have to deal with this. Grandma would be the only working one, while Grandpa would be drinking. I had my childhood taken away from me because of his actions." The boy asked his father, "Dad, why were you so angry at life?" The father said, "Son, I had lost my best friend. He was like my brother. My mother was the only one who would support the family. I had a father who cared more about drinking than his own family. Later on, I had gotten into trouble with the law, but no matter what it was, my mother would always be by my side. They put me in a program called Circle." The boy asked, "What is the Circle?" The father responded, "A new beginning, my son. I started there with faces that I would despise. Then, to later on, find myself to cherish and never forget. I came in with a reckless attitude and the world's biggest chip on my shoulder. As time progressed, I find myself to open up and to loosen this chip. It was hard to believe that these strangers became my family. See, my son, the man you see before you is a lot more different than I who used to be," said the father. "My son, it took time to progress into the person you see today. I am much more mature and have found a way to control my anger and hate. No longer do I have these feelings of wanting to die or harm another person. For my son, words are stronger than punches. My outlook on life is among the biggest change. For my son, it is life that is the most meaningful thing. I pray every night that you follow the right path and have God steer you away from the path I was on. I now take responsibilities for my actions, for you are not a man, son, until you do so, son. If you ever find yourself to slip or fall among life, always get back up on your feet, harder and stronger than ever. I now appreciate everything that circle has taught me. I would not be who I am today, for it's not for them. I have learned to walk away from trouble and to know my right from wrong. In addition, to make amends to the mistakes you have done in life. This man has learned that you must be honest to those who matter, because the truth will set you free. See, my life was tough because I made it tough for my life. People do care for you, my son, even if they seem that they do not, they do. Anything in life is possible. Just believe in yourself as I have, and it will be done. I now have peace among myself, and no longer do I await death to come get me. I grew a bond with strangers whom I call family. The most important thing that I learned was that it takes time to change, and to be respected, you must earn it, for it is not given to you. The boy sat there, amazed by these words of wisdom and knowledge, along with shock for who his father once was. See, my son, life is full of surprises. Tell me, my son, what do you hope to gain in life? Well, father, I hope to be a great father and to have a job in law enforcement. Also to have a good house with a lot of land out there. To also have my children raised into well-behaved children in society. A beautiful wife that can take care of the kids while I handle everything else. I think that is about it, father. Oh, and to be well respected as you are. Those are the words of a young person who went through the circle process, and that's his perception about what it meant for him and what he learned from that process. And I think it's probably more powerful than anything I can tell you about circle, but I will talk a bit about how we create that space that had that impact on his life. So the circle is, the peacemaking circle that I work in is based on the American Indian Talking Circle. It involves, when we use it in the justice system, this process involves the victim supporters, the person who committed the crime, offender supporters, and interested community members in a structured dialogue about what happened, why it happened, what the impact is, and what's needed to repair the harm and prevent it from happening again. All the goals of a restorative justice process. Participants sit in a circle without tables or other furniture. An object called a talking piece circulates in order among the participants, who speak only when they're holding the talking piece. The use of the talking piece reduces the role of the facilitator and eliminates crosstalk or interruptions, because the talking piece designates who may speak while all others listen. The process in its justice application sometimes involves separate circles for the victim and for the offender before they bring everyone together to determine the action plan to address all the issues raised in the process. By consensus, the circle may develop the sentence for the offender and may also stipulate responsibilities of community members and justice officials as part of the agreement. Circle process is rooted in ancient traditions and incorporates contemporary understandings about living in rapidly changing multicultural societies. Ancient communities used processes similar to circles to attend to the work of community, as do many current indigenous communities around the world. We believe it is a common form of collective engagement around issues of interest to a community across the ages and around the globe. The circle process that I work in derives most directly from traditions of various First Nations and Native American people who still use circles and embody core teachings related to circles in their way of life. Circle process is also informed by modern experience in dialogue, consensus building, cross-cultural communication, recognition of individual interests, change theory, and personal transformation. The process balances the ancient with the contemporary, the individual with the group, the inner and outer self. The circle is a technique for organizing effective group communication, relationship building, decision making, and conflict resolution. Even more important, the circle embodies and nurtures a philosophy of relationship and interconnectedness that can guide us in all circumstances, in circle and outside of circle. The circle is an intentional space designed to support participants in bringing forward their best self, to help them conduct themselves based on the values that represent who they are when they are at their best. The circle creates a protected space to practice that best self, value-based behavior, when it might feel risky to do so. The more people practice that behavior in circle, the more those habits are strengthened to carry that behavior into other parts of their lives. The foundation of circle structure includes the values that nurture good relationships with others and key teachings common among indigenous communities. Together, those values and ancient teachings create a strong root system to support the creation of a container that can hold anger, frustration, joy, pain, truth, conflict, diverse worldviews, intense feelings, silence, and paradox. To create the values foundation of the circle, participants identify values they feel are important for healthy process and good outcomes for all. Typical values that are generated in circles when the participants identify their values are honesty, respect, openness, caring, courage, patience, and humility. The exact words vary with each group, but the values generated by circles across a wide variety of contexts are consistent in their essence. We find them to be universal. They describe who we want to be in our best self. The values in the circle are not taken for granted, nor are they imposed by the facilitator. Conscious conversation by participants about the values they wish to hold in a collective space is a critical part of the circle process. The indigenous roots of the circle process contribute key teachings to the foundation of the circle. These teachings are often associated with the circle image as a metaphor for how the universe operates. For many indigenous people, the circle is a symbol that conveys a worldview, a way of understanding how the world works. And there are several teachings that are an integral part of that worldview and an integral part of the space of circle. The first, and for me the most important teaching, of that worldview is that everything is interconnected, profoundly interconnected. Us as human beings and our relationship to all of the other aspects of creation, to the earth, to the waters, to the other animals. Everything is profoundly interconnected. Second, indigenous teaching, important for circles, though everything is connected, there are distinct parts, and it is important for those to be in balance. We are unique as individuals, and yet we are profoundly interconnected. The third teaching that's important for circles is that every part of the universe contributes to the whole and is equally valuable. In circles, we are equals. Everyone has the same opportunity for voice, for speaking. Everyone's ideas are equally important to the circle. This assumption that everything is interconnected has profound implications for human relationships. It means that it is not possible to drop out, kick out, or get rid of anyone or anything. It means that exclusion is never a solution. We must learn to deal with the difficulties that we have with one another. We must find our way through. These shared values and ancient teachings infuse every aspect of the process. They shape the attitude of the facilitator, and they define the atmosphere or climate of the space the facilitator is trying to create with circle participants. They are a vision of the possibilities for the group. Participants are often not in a place reflective of those values and teachings when they enter the circle, especially when we're working in the justice system. The intention of circle is to help them step in the direction of those values and teachings from whatever place they were in when they entered. Every step of a circle process works towards building and nurturing the capacity of participants to act according to the values and teachings. To support movement participants toward those values and teachings, the circle process must model those values and teachings in every way possible. The circle uses several structural elements to achieve that kind of space. One of those is the use of guidelines that are generated by the group. Those are the agreements that the group makes about how they will be together. The use of the talking piece is probably the single most important tool of the circle process. It shares the opportunity for voice, it makes space for quiet people, and it limits the power of the facilitator in very important ways. Circles use opening and closing ceremony to mark this as a space apart and help people transition from our normal interactions to a space of much deeper interaction. The circle uses storytelling as the primary form of teaching. We share stories from our own lives as a way of offering possibilities rather than cognitive lessons. The role of the facilitator in the circle is different than in most other processes. And all the decisions made in circle are made by consensus. And we define that to mean that everyone can live with it. You don't have to be wildly enthusiastic, but you need to walk out the door saying, I can support that decision. There are a couple of other very important characteristics of the circle process. One is that in circle, we do relationship building before discussing the core issue. Circles deliberately delay the dialogue about the contentious issues until the group has done some work on relationship building. An introduction round with a question inviting people to share something about themselves. the creation of circle values and guidelines, and a storytelling round on a topic related to the key issue, but not about the key issue, precede the discussion of the difficult issues that are the focus of the circle. These parts of the circle generate a deeper awareness within the circle of how their human journeys have generated similar experiences, expectations, fears, dreams, and hopes. These opening parts of the circle also present participants to one another in unexpected ways, gently challenging assumptions they may have made about one another. Creating guidelines together provides an opportunity for the group to experience finding common ground in spite of differences. A circle intentionally does not get right to the issues. Taking time to create a sense of shared space and connection in the group increases the level of emotional safety, which allows deeper truth-telling. It also promotes awareness of the humanity of all participants. Another characteristic that's very important is shared leadership. Several of the structural elements and characteristics of circle shift responsibility from the facilitator to all the participants in a circle. The collective creation of values and guidelines for the circle engages the entire circle in setting expectations for conduct in the circle. When that happens, participants are more likely to take responsibility for making sure those expectations are met and less likely to rely on the facilitator as an enforcer. The use of the talking piece moving in order around the circle to regulate the dialogue dramatically reduces the role and power of the facilitator. In many processes, the facilitator has the power to determine who will have a chance to speak, and the facilitator can speak at any time. In a circle, the facilitator may speak without the talking piece, but only does that if there's a serious process challenge that must be addressed. The quality of the process is a responsibility of all the participants, not just the facilitator. Because the facilitator sits as an equal in the process and generally only speaks when the talking piece comes, there's less tendency to depend on the facilitator for solutions or control. There are numerous ways that circles are being used. We won't have time to talk about those in detail, but I just want to mention that they range from using circle to celebrate a wonderful event in the life of a family or of an individual, to using circles to determine a sentence, a very challenging and complex kind of circle, and many kinds of circles in between, and that they're being used quite extensively in schools and to some degree in the justice system. I want to make sure we have time for questions. So I'm going to do my closing remarks and then open it up for questions. I want to return to the idea of interconnectedness. I will share a story from my country. An African-American man moved his family out of a bad neighborhood to protect his son. He did everything he could to provide a positive environment and support a healthy teen. And his son was all he hoped for. And then his son was killed in an accidental shooting by someone from a bad neighborhood. A media interviewer commented to him that he had done everything he could for his son. And he replied, "No, I did not. I forgot one thing. I forgot to care about other people's children." We are profoundly interconnected. There is no escape in the long run. What's happening to others will affect us eventually. Shifting to that mindset is an enormous shift, at least for us in the U.S. It means we can never benefit at the expense of others. It means we can't take the easy way out of avoiding conflict or ignoring problems. It can also be an enormously uplifting mindset that we are all interconnected. It means we are never alone. It means we always belong, no matter what happens. The fear of not belonging, or the pain of feeling that you do not belong, is at the root of much violence and harm in the world. Living as if everyone belongs might be the biggest violence prevention measure we could ever devise. Restorative practices help us live as if everyone belongs. The restorative impulse is always directed toward healing from the harm of disconnection. Thank you so much for listening.
I would just like you to wait the microphone to get to you, because we are recording and we're going to have all of this in our website. So Isaac is helping us out here, so we'll go from here and there. Next question. One at a time, please. I would like to ask you to explain, please, a bit more about the work of the facilitator. What is his role in the circle? Did you get that? Okay. That's all.
The role of the facilitator in a circle is to help the group, the participants in the circle, create their space. To help them through the process of designing their own space with values and guidelines, and help them build some relationships with their early work in relationship building, and through that to create this container where people can speak truth in a respectful way. And once that container is created, then the responsibility of the keeper, or the facilitator, we use the term keeper a lot, the role of the facilitator is to monitor the quality of the space. And if the space is becoming unsafe, to bring that to the attention of the group and turn it over to the group to figure out what they want to do about that. So to help create the quality of the space and then monitor the quality of the space. How is a question, you know, that takes several days of training. But I mentioned several of the parts of that. It is the discussion of values. It is the use of ceremony to separate from the way we normally are in the world. It is the use of the facilitator's own personal vulnerability to create a safety for other people to share their vulnerability. Those are some of the techniques that we use in Circle to create that kind of space.
Good evening. Please, I would like you to tell us what is the period of duration of these meeting sessions and how often they're held?
The length of time of a Circle and how frequently they're held depends completely upon what the particular application is. So let me just give a few examples. In an elementary school where they began to use circles for playground conflict, a typical circle would be one time and be about 45 minutes. In the justice system where they're working with youth who have complicated underlying issues, they would meet every 2 weeks for 2 hours. And that might be for up to a year. It might be only a couple of months, but it might be up to a year. So each use of the circle is designed to fit that particular context. In the prisons in Minnesota, Circles are an option for staff conflict resolution. It has nothing to do with the inmates. For conflict among staff, they can ask to use a circle. They have only 2 hours. It's always a 2-hour time frame. If they cannot work through all the things they need to talk about in 2 hours, they come back again another time. So in each case, it's flexible and designed to meet the needs of the people who are using Circle. And I want to go back to the first question, because I thought of one of the things that contributes enormously to creating the kind of safe space where people take responsibility is the talking piece. It is probably the single most critical element. The use of a talking piece in which when someone has the talking piece, no one else speaks. It creates an enormous amount of safety for people in a process, and it encourages people to take responsibility because it reduces reliance on the facilitator.
Good evening. Well, would you have an experience to tell us about how to elaborate or create a culture in the community to implement the circles?
You're going to know more about this than I do, because it's very culturally rooted. But I can talk about the way I approached it, because my job at the Department of Corrections, I worked for the Department of Corrections to promote restorative practices around the state. And the first thing that I did was public speaking. I used to say that anytime two or more people will gather, I will come and talk to you about these ideas. So going out and speaking wherever people would gather. And also it was very important to me in doing that public speaking that I never saw it as my job to convince or persuade. My job was simply to offer a vision of what was possible, to offer some ideas, and then wherever people were responsive to that energy, then I would work with them more and more to help them learn about what are the different restorative practices, where are the opportunities in their community. I always describe myself as an opportunist, that I was always scanning for where is the opening. And in some communities, it was with a civic organization, sometimes with a judge, sometimes with a police officer, sometimes with a teacher in a school. It didn't matter to me where it started. Wherever there was energy and excitement about the ideas, I would work with those people. So the public speaking, and then as we began to do some things, trying to get the media to share the story of what was happening with a larger public, finding out where do people gather. So in Minnesota, people gather in churches and in civic organizations, and we would go to those organizations, talk about the work we were doing, and ask who's interested in coming to be a volunteer for us. And constantly reaching out to people, any place that we had relationships and connections, and letting it grow. And I've become aware that particular approach is American. When I talk with people in Europe recently, on a trip to Denmark and Norway, they said the same thing would not work in the same way in Europe. Americans have a history of revolution. We rebelled against the king, and there's a certain amount of rebellion still in American citizens. And so movements are common in the U.S., and the capacity to engage citizens in sort of redirecting their government is significant in the U.S., much more so than in Canada or in In Europe, and to some degree, it's because in Europe and Canada, governments have been benevolent, and the citizens didn't feel a need to redirect the government. So some of what we do in the U.S., we call community organizing, may or may not be relevant to your context. I'm not sure about that. But community organizing, for us, was a big part of how to spread a different culture. And another thing that's been growing in our work in restorative justice is our realization, and this was, Gandhi had this wisdom long ago, but of course we always keep need to rediscover in our own lives. But many of us working in restorative justice have realized that we have to live it in our own families, in our own neighborhoods, in our own workplaces. And that is often the hardest part, is to hold open the possibility of goodness in someone who's getting in my way. When we are passionate about restorative justice and people get in our way, we start to demonize them. But that's exactly the problem that got us in the place that we're in. And so we have to remain in a place of compassion for the people who are making it difficult for us to do the work we want to do. Because that's ultimately what this vision calls us to. This applies to everyone, not just to the people who agree with us. And I believe it's a very long journey, at least for me. It's a very long journey.
We have an issue with time, and we just let some precious seconds go right by us, and we need to wrap up with the last question. I'm sorry to say that.
I apologize because my Portuguese is not very good, so I have to pose my question in English. You spoke about the very ingenious device of talking peace. My question is sort of technical. How does it pass from hand to hand? Is there a certain limit of time that each person gets to speak? And how does the group deal if one person wants to hog, you know, to keep the talking piece and go on and on and on and on and on, not leaving the chance to other people to speak? Thank you.
You've just raised one of the key questions that gets asked in training. It does just go from hand to hand around the circle. And generally, you try to use a talking piece that has meaning to people, that will help create the atmosphere of respect. I'm never casual about a talking piece. I think very carefully about either using something I can give meaning to or finding something that has meaning to the group. Generally speaking, you can just allow it to move around. But if you're in a situation where you know there's someone in the group who has a tendency to talk a long time, or if you're in a situation where time is very tight, for instance, we did some circles with 25 people about a conflict in a faith community, and we only had 2.5 hours. It's not a lot of time for 25 people to speak. We still needed to do the relationship building first and identify values first. So when we did a relationship building question, we asked people to answer in 2 sentences. We asked them what this community meant to them, and we asked them to answer in 2 sentences. Now, we didn't enforce this rigorously. Many people spoke more than 2 sentences, but it did let people know that they needed to keep it not too long. So generally, you try to give some guidance to people before you start if there are concerns about time. If, in spite of that, someone speaks too long, that's a situation in which the facilitator may speak without the talking piece and interrupt gently and just remind the person that there are many other people still to speak and it's important for everyone to have voice. And one of the techniques for doing that is to say, we really want to understand what's most important to you, and we need to make sure everyone has a chance to speak. Could you summarize in two sentences what's most important that you want us to understand about what you feel or what you've been thinking. And then that's a way of trying to really honor the person and still move it along.
Professor, is there any email which everybody here could send you some questions to?
Yes. People can email me anytime. And did you put it in the book, Leah? Did you put it in? Is it in the back of the book? I know in the original English version, it's in the back of the book. But my email is my name, KAYPRANIS at MSN.com. And for any of you who can read English, there's a number of books published by a nonprofit publisher in St. Paul that's called Living Justice Press. And their website is livingjusticepress.org. And they have information on the website, and they publish books about circles. And from there, they have links to some other websites. There's a lot of wonderful work happening around the world, bringing back this ancient wisdom to help us remember who we are in community.
Só confirmando, é Kay Prannis, KAYPRANIS, @msn.com.
She's just restating your email to them. Professor, thank you very much. On behalf of Paulus Atenas Association, the Paulista Committee for the Decade of Peace Culture, I'd like to thank you greatly of the generosity of having your presence here, and everybody is invited to celebrate the launch of the book, Circle Processes, Theory and Practice. Thank you, everybody.